Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Well, thank you, Anne. This is Anne's idea tonight. And I actually said to David, what on earth did we agree to this for? Anyway, here we are. Jared didn't accede to that at all, but anyway, I knew he was quietly thinking it. So welcome, everyone, and it's lovely to be here. And what we will do is I've invited both gentlemen. I'll make a few little remarks, and I've invited both gentlemen to speak for about 6 to 7 minutes. Then I'll do a little bit of a Q&A, and then I will throw it over to your good selves, and I won't be as acerbic as Jared is in telling you all to sit down and speak up and so on, but that is what you will have to do. Stay out of the camera. Anyway, I'll attempt to, you know, be a good substitute. As we discuss the art of argument, which I actually think, even though it was Anne's idea, that in fact, certainly Jared, I'm not quite sure about David, gets more feedback from his and David's stashes on Insider than virtually anything else he does. And she said, wouldn't it be fun, she said, I think it was something to that effect, if the two of them, they both agreed to sit together and talk about it, would you be the MC? So I thought, oh yes, that sounds interesting. Then of course you get closer and you think, oh yes, so this could be quite character building. But but in fact, the more I thought about it, the more I thought we have a real opportunity tonight, dare I say, to think about the nature of political public discourse in Australia. Most of us, I don't think, like what passes for political discourse, but I'm quite willing to be told something different. I remember hearing Robert Mann, I discussed with Jared on the phone, we agree it was about 6 to 7 years ago when he gave up the column in the... didn't you say it was when he gave up his regular column?
Yeah, in The Age, I think.
In The Age, said, we've lost the art of argument in Australia, and by that he meant, if I recall it, I've looked for it and couldn't find it, and Jared's extraordinary, files didn't necessarily throw it up either, that the business of responding to an opponent's suggestions when you weren't necessarily ready for them, a la a good university tutorial, where you had to assemble your material on the run, dependent upon what your opponent delivered to you. So it was the true art of argument. It had elements of trumping and wit, but it was primarily linked with the nature of the evidence presented. Whereas he said, we've replaced that with a gotcha moments and with a sort of trumping mentality. So I throw that in as a thought as I was sort of pondering today. Also remember that Richard King, that very good writer in Perth, who does excellent reviews, and I interviewed him about his book on hypocrisies. And he, of course, said, I think that it's when one disagrees that then you have your best discussions. Whereas he said, that's not what occurs in Australia these days. He was inviting people to consider disagreement as the kick-off point for a good discussion as opposed to closing it down. And my third little bit of evidence, as I was thinking about this, was a Scotsman who was for a short time, he died quite tragically, he was head of the Australian Institute of Family Studies, and this was years ago when I was on Life Matters, and he said to me, and this is when I was in despair about the nature of political discussion, he said, but at least you have public discussion in Australia. And I said, really, do we? And he said, oh yeah, he said, in England, this is in the 90s, in England, it's all done below decks, as it were. So we pretend there's public discussion, but actually we all know we're engaging in rhetoric, talk, of which the English do very well. But actually nothing is really decided in the public realm. And you actually do in Australia, even with your ghastly talkbacks and so on, and your shock jocks, things occur in the to the public agenda, which is, I think, an interesting challenge. And I've I was amazed when he said it, because I thought that a good Scotsman would deplore what passed for public discussion, but he didn't. So I just, in other words, I think it's quite a provocative set of thoughts that we're going to debate tonight. I think we both see Jared and David on Insiders. I cringe and go into a sort of semi-fetal position. Others clearly love it. So I'm waiting to hear how both gentlemen, I've asked them both, to reflect personally first, they see whether they obey me, before they go into broader issues about definitions, as to when they have both felt under that something is at stake in these personal interactions on Insiders, that they haven't necessarily programmed, when they've liked it, when they've hated it, what's lost and what's won from the types of interactions that our lovable Jared and David do so well. So, first to you, David. Yes. How would you answer that? Your personal memories before you care to think more broadly about the art of argument.
There is an unhealthy public appetite for the sight of Jared and me scrapping early on Sunday mornings. It is astonishing, and I am always saddened by strangers who come up to me and say, I love it when you and Jared are on the show and I'm giving it to Jared. This happens in the most extraordinary places. 18 months ago, I was in Vienna, and I had just entered St. Stephen's Cathedral, Stephansdom, for those of you who are familiar with the city, and this guy came up to me and said, no, don't tell me, insiders, I love you when you're on with, no, don't tell me, that guy, you give it to him. And I said, I think you're talking about my colleague Jared Henderson, and I don't particularly enjoy those moustaches at all that happen, and I don't enjoy them. But let me tell you something of what it is like on Insiders. The stoushes sometimes begin in the green room beforehand. And while Jared is not a reporter, something that we might come back to later in the show, later in our discussions, because we're different people. I'm a journalist, he's something else, I don't quite know. Sui generis, I think. Jared's reports of the pre-show stoushes are spectacularly accurate. I don't think there's to be any kind of doubt whatever. They're extremely good reports. We meet for decreasingly luxurious breakfast and coffee in a corner of the ABC library, just down from the studio. And we arrive, you know, separately. And if Jared has written something aggressive about me in a few days before, I sometimes bring it up with him. And this is a bad idea. It's a silly idea. And I shouldn't do it. But more often than not, we're very cheerful with one another. We find topics to talk about. Then we go into the studio and we sit down in that hideous set. Ladies and gentlemen, is that set not hideous? And, ladies and gentlemen, is it not a lie? It does not matter what the weather is like in Melbourne that morning, but you are given the impression, a totally false impression, of a sunny autumn morning on the Yarra. It is a lie. Anyway, we sit down there, and then they take a photograph of us because they tweet the photograph. And so Jared and I usually find something to do for the photograph. I quite like just putting my hand on his knee. And Jared is marvellous at this point, and he sort of looks solemnly forward as though it's some kind of bizarre wedding shot. And out they go. Out they go. And I'm told that, you know, it immediately attracts, you know, an audience of some kind. You know, everybody is waiting for the, you know, the Jared and David moment. Jared likes to get in early. And so what he does is he comes at me with a completely outrageous statement, something like, you know, you said Tony Abbott would never win the election. And I'm completely flummoxed by this because it's just not true. And, of course, when I'm flummoxed in this way and feel misrepresented, I immediately climb onto my high horse. And the high horse is a very stupid place to be on television, even though there seems to be an appetite for it out there in the public. And we have a little ding-dong. And Jared's next line always is, when I reply furiously to some allegation like, you know, you never, he said he would never win, but actually on page 4 of my essay I said he was heading for a mighty victory. Jared's next line is a tremendously clever line. He says, "You're very sensitive." And that works very well as well, to get me even higher onto my high horse. And at that point, I usually say something pretty grand, like, "I'm very sensitive to being lied about on television," or something like that. And at about this point, apparently hundreds of thousands of people across Australia, who would be much better off at Mass at that time on a Sunday morning, are thoroughly enjoying ourselves. I don't enjoy these exchanges. I think that they're pretty pointless. Because I think, apart from the sort of circus aspect of it, the point of public argument is to get to the facts, and to get to the facts and to bring judgment to bear on the facts, so that we can, you know, deal with substantial issues, bring our very different attitudes to bear on those facts, and give Australia the advice it so clearly needs. But this is, I must say, with all due respect, difficult with Jared, and I had not quite worked out what it was all about until reading his unique biography of Santa Maria. And here on page 153 is the definition of Jared's approach. Now, what Jared is discussing here is the series of controversies that broke out over the years, because that little worm, Santa Maria, got out of going to war because Mannix put in a good word for him with the government. Now, Jared does not admire him avoiding service in that way, but he does admire tremendously how Santa Maria, over the years, dealt with various eruptions of this scandal as it came along to haunt him. And on page 153 of the book, Jared says, "The response was Santa Maria at his argumentative best. He once told me that if criticism was well-founded and documented, it was best to ignore it. But if the prosecution's case contained factual errors, it should be attacked with ferocity so as to discredit the source. Also, he advised that wherever possible, it was useful to query a critic's motive." Now, that's Jared's MO. The problem with that MO is that it is not entirely, of course, but it is largely about why we should not deal with the facts. And my view is that the public wants us to deal with the facts, and that ad hominem argument about the political positions of our adversaries or of the personal lives of our adversaries are all very well and give a certain amount of colour to argument, and I would never say they're entirely out of place. But my view is that in the terribly difficult business of persuading people to understand complex reality or to change their minds about the reality of life in this country, issues that face us in this country, what people want us to do is to move to the facts, to get to the facts, and to bring our values and our intelligence to bear on analysing those facts. I'm distressed that so much public debate in this country is about slanging away at each other, at our adversaries, rather than moving to the facts. Now, I'll say a bit more about this later as the show goes on, but while we bring colour and movement to the Insiders show, I much, much prefer it when we get to those parts of Insiders where Jared and I bring very different points of view to bear on the facts that are being discussed. That, I think, is where we might, from time to time, actually be useful to the country.
Thank you very much. Jared. Are you ready?
Well, thank you, Dave. Thank you, David. I think most of David's analysis was pretty accurate, except for the facts, I think. It is true that I have reported some of these exchanges in my Media Watchdog blog, which goes out every Friday after lunch, of course, and I have reported some of these. I think some of our exchanges on insiders are exaggerated because they don't actually happen. The truth is that David and I have only been on insiders together twice in the last year, which we're
really?
Fronting up again on the 21st. Yeah, I've got all the figures here. Ah! Being a little factoid, I produced them all, so I can tell you what it is. So it's only two in the last year. So it's not that much, but people think we're on
all the time.
Yeah, so it's very interesting. And it is true what David said. I mean, on the last occasion we were on together, he did suggest that he should put his hand on my knee. And I'm trying to be very friendly at this stage, and I suggest perhaps I should put my hand on his knee as well, but he advised against that. Probably for good reason, I suspect. And I get similar reactions. I mean, in December, I'd just been up to get my eyes tested, and I had all this stuff on my eyes, and I was having trouble, more trouble than usual, seeing early after breakfast. And this guy came up to me, and he was repairing gas cylinders in the commercial buildings just off Hunter Street, and he said, "Are you this boy, Gerard Henderson?" And I said, "Are you the guys on Insiders?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "God, mate," he said, "keep giving them to those lefties every Sunday, would you, mate?" So I do my best. But it is true that the best exchanges we've ever had were never filmed. There was a memorable exchange when we used to fly Qantas. We now fly Virgin. When David was kind enough to meet me as I came off the plane, he being higher up, he wasn't in business, he was just further up, as he should be, I suppose. I was further back, as I should be. And he waited, we walked down, and he made a comment, and I made what I thought was a perfectly innocuous comment. He's never been so offended in all his life, and we had this huge row as people getting in and out of taxis. There was another one in the green room, and there was famously one on the set in between the breaks, which I do think related to Tony Abbott, where David did let off a bit about me, and I was deeply offended. But I said very little whilst David was ranting, and what I noticed was no one wanted to be involved. Barry Cassidy started looking at the lights on the ceiling, and George Megalogina started switching papers and saying, "Do you really have to be like this, blokes?" So those things, I think, I'm trying to get the producers to film them, because I think they're probably more engaging than what goes on the program. Now, it is... I was... David came up with the suggestion, the art of government. I'd suggest it...
The art of argument.
I'd suggest it, heaven and hell and all that junk, but he thought it wasn't serious.
Jazz.
So that was rejected. Not the first time in my life I've been rejected. So I did put together a bit of a paper, and I'll come back and just highlight a couple of points. But the essential criticism of me is actually that I'm a factoid, that I'm too obsessed with facts. And I'm happy to bear that. I mean, I think that's a good way to go. I'm pleased that David's read Santa Maria, or most of Santa Maria, Most Unusual Man, and I've read all of his, I think, very good essay on Bill Shorten. So, and I've also read Joraline's book, and we've all read one another's books. But the central criticism of me that I'm a factoid, and the point I make about Santa Maria is, I mean, I was a critic of Santa Maria, I was also an ally for a time, but Santa Maria had many, many faults, but he was a brilliant polemicist. He was a brilliant polemicist because interarched in with all his polemics, which he did on Channel 9 on a Sunday morning, speaking directly to camera for 7 minutes without an autocue, it's a pretty fine achievement. Because if you look at what he said, or you read the scripts of what he said, he had a lot of polemics, but interlaced with the polemics was a huge amount of facts, of quotes, of reference to places, of what people said. And I think that is really the essential bit of argument. Now, I can understand why persons on one side of the Santa Maria argument, on the other side of the Santa Maria argument. But what Santa Maria taught me when I was young, and I was associated with him between 1965 and 75, was in a sense the art of polemics. What we had in common is that in an environment in this country which is predominantly left, as David himself said at the University of Sydney, at the UTS in Sydney in 2004, that the culture of journalism, media, and it's also true of the social science departments, is primarily left. And so if you're going to counter that culture, as I tend to do, I mean, you just can't go in with opinion. So I try to be courteous, I try to be polite, I was well brought up, although it was a long time ago. But I also try to present facts and to be fierce with facts. And I don't regard the main exchanges I would have with someone as exchanges on insiders, because in a sense we're responding to what's the latest news, and we're asked questions and we're asked to respond. And this is the first occasion I've ever been with David on a platform. I'm not disreputable enough to be invited to literary festivals where you meet people like David. I tend to stay at home and walk Nancy and do things like that. But what I would argue very briefly, I mean, as someone who was young and influenced, I mean, I was influenced obviously by George Orwell, but also by Malcolm Muggeridge, because Muggeridge had this irreverence, but irreverence was intertwined with lots of references to facts, and I still greatly admire Muggeridge's 1940s book, The 30s. But what I say in all my arguments is, and I do a lot of these arguments these days in Media Watchdog, I do some in my Australian column, and I do some on insiders, and that's about all I really do. I mean, I do insiders about 7 or 8 times a year, and that's pretty well all my public appearances. That's what they are. But I just make a couple of points. I mean, I think I focus all the time on facts, quotes, places, people, and all that stuff. I think memory is completely unreliable. I mean, you quoted Robert Mann, and I'm always happy to listen to quotes from Robert Mann, but I'm announcing today that the $16,000 gift we're giving to Robert, I'm increasing to $20,000. If he can produce evidence of the facts I allegedly sent him in 1993, or it might have been 95, or it might have been 98, and it might have been sent to him and two others saying that he should be sacked as an aged journalist. Of course, I never sent it, and I could only afford $12,000, but fortunately, Perth Neurosurgery got interested in this, and they put in another lot to take it up to 16, and now I'm taking it up to 20. My $12,000 got to go to an asylum seeker cause, but the neurosurgeon in Perth reckons Robert needs a bit of a break, and he can use it for holidays. At any rate, it's $20,000 cash. It's not a bet. Just produce the document. He reckons there are 3 copies around. I make that as a serious point, because whilst I've got a reasonably good memory, I never rely on memory, because I think memory is extraordinarily unreliable. Many people who are very intelligent, very clever, and honest, like Robert Mann, have very clear recollections of events that never happened. In fact, I understand that Ronald Reagan once said, someone told me this, that he said, before he got Alzheimer's, in his days when he was a vibrant president, he said to this guy, this American guy who spoke to him, who had made a mistake about one of his Hollywood films, he said, one of Reagan's Hollywood films, he said, "Don't worry, Charles," he said, "some of my clearest recollections are of events that never happened." And this is the case in Robert. But at any rate, 20,000 is pretty good, and Apex got the news tonight. What I tried to do, believe it or not, is I tried to avoid abuse. There's an awful lot of abuse in this paper I've just put in. I mean, I've just got, because David and I have discussed this before, just quotes from the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age about this extraordinary abuse about George Pell being published in the last couple of weeks. It's not clever. It's not intelligent. It's not based on fact. It's just abuse. I always try to avoid abuse.
Any of it mine?
What was that?
Any of it mine?
No, I haven't quoted you. No.
Just want like that to be clear to everyone.
This is a Ma-free paper, yes. I try and avoid hyperbole and prophecy, because hyperbole is the enemy of evidence, and all we know about the future is that we don't know anything about the future. I do love prophets because I quote them a lot, but I've never met one that matters. And my favourite, of course, is the false prophet of Palm Beach, Bob Ellis, and I wish him well, because I want Bob to keep on making prophecies, because I record them every year and produce them at the end. But just to conclude, I mean, I think the art of argument is really not dissimilar to what the German sociologist Max Weber said about the art of politics and democratic societies. He was writing in between the wars. That politics is really about slow boring through hard boards. And I think that's the same with argument. That the art of argument requires a commitment to establish fact and a certain irreverence towards intellectual fashions of the day, which in Australia are essentially on the left. That is not the case in all societies all the time. So I tend to agree with David that what matters is fact. I mean, you can always disagree on the interpretation of fact, but in David's book, most recent essay, which is a fine essay, the material on Bill Shorten, he has his opinions, but it's surrounded by facts, and I think in my own way I have my opinions and they're surrounded by facts, but people will disagree on the interpretation of facts, or more significantly, I think, the importance of facts.
Not over there. No. Thank you, Gerard, very much indeed. Now, it's very interesting because I would have said, I would have thought that it's your capacity to set up very strong opinions about people and motives that actually, I mean, going back to Santa's, your quote, that in fact characterises you rather than the use of facts. So it's interesting, that's what you see yourself as doing. And sometimes I feel with you, like actually I have found a lot of your asylum seeker material because I know that you have a different view, but I think you have a very broad-based view on the dilemmas involved in asylum seeker policy, and you allow me into those nuances, strangely enough. In other areas, I don't think you do as much. So you allow nuance, in my opinion, to enter some of your discussions around asylum seekers, which you don't in other areas. And
but the facts are always there. I mean, when I started columns, which was nearly 30 years ago now, I've written a column every week for 28 years, I think, I decided that because of my unfashionable opinions that people weren't going to read my opinions because they wouldn't be interested in them by and large, or they would disagree with them. But I thought, if you put a lot of facts in them, they may read my columns because they're interested in what I quote and what I say and form their own opinions about my opinions. And I think I've tried to do it that way. So every column I write has a lot of facts in it. Now, I mean, you approach different topics differently, and I understand what you're saying there. But if you look at my stuff, there's a lot of facts in it, as there is, I mean, traditionally in David Marr's work. I mean, he's quoted my biography of Santa Maria. I'll mention his biography of Barwick. I mean, you may disagree with it, parts of it, but it's got a lot of facts in it, and that's why I think that sort of material works. And I think that's one of the reasons why, I just turn up on insiders when people ask me. I mean, I'm a courteous guy, and if someone says come along, I come along, but I don't really think that's not a place where I sort of build a case. And I occasionally build a case on the ABC. I mean, every 25 years Philip Adam has asked me on the programme, and I turn up, and I've just had a go last year, so I reckon in 25 years, which is around God, whatever it is, I'll be back.
You'll be gone. But do you think of yourself as a gladiator?
Well, not really. I don't have many shields, you know.
I think of you as a gladiator.
The only thing different to me from David, really, is that in the circles in which you and I, the three of us and others here, work, is that I'm essentially saying unfashionable things. I mean, I'm saying that I think George Pell's been very harshly treated by the media. I'm saying that I think Tony Abbott was quite a clever guy. I'm saying that I still support the Allied policy in Vietnam. I mean, the reason why I'm regarded as a gladiator is because I say unfashionable things. If I said exactly the opposite, with exactly the same number of facts, people would think it was just what they heard that morning tea at the ABC, or it was what everyone was propounding that editorial in the Sydney Morning Herald. I mean, the only reason I'm a gladiator is because I'm sort of by myself. I look around. I mean, when I was young, and I used to vote DLP, and I remember Bob Santa Maria saying to me, he'd been to Sydney, and he met Professor David Armstrong, the philosophy professor, and came back and told me that Armstrong voted Democratic Labour Party. And I said, what? Apart from Frank Knopfelmacher of Melbourne, I'd never met an academic who devoted to your peer. When suddenly someone say to me, someone agrees with you, I'd look around and say, can that be right? So I think there's a reason why I'm a gladiator is that I'm sort of out there. I'm okay. Sort of on the bridge with no one behind me. Quite frankly, it's quite a nice place to be if you're not very sociable.
You love it!
But I do find when you're on your own, the company's better.
David.
He actually said that. It's a fact. Okay, now let's get serious about this. My view is, Gerard, that you are a gladiator. I'm something else. Yes, I have I have issues and subjects that interest me deeply, and I've written about them over many, many years. But there's a profound difference between us, and I think there's a very neat way of showing it. And that is Jared's view that politicians shouldn't speak to people like me. Now, journalists don't hold views like that. Journalists' views are that we want to get to speak to whoever we can, and we want to get access to whatever documents we can, and that's our job. Our job is getting to people and getting to documents. But, in fact, that unseemly row at the Melbourne airport was provoked by him telling me that Tony Abbott was foolish to have spoken to me.
I said George Pell was smart not to speak to you.
George Pell was smart to speak to you. Now, that is not the instinct of a journalist. And Jared has also told me that Tony Abbott was foolish to speak to me. And I thought, maybe I'm deluding myself here, that how can somebody who believes in public debate actually advise politicians not to speak? And there I was researching my my Bill Shorten piece, and there's Jane Cadzo's very good profile of Bill Shorten. And Jane is with Bill Shorten somewhere or other, and they bump into Jared. And Jared says to Shorten, you shouldn't be talking to Jane Cadzo. Now, for a journalist, this is weird. This is a weird instinct to be saying things like this. It's just weird.
Makes you suspicious of him, doesn't it?
No, it's not suspicious. I just, where do we place Jared? You know, he is a gladiator. And in a way, it is completely remarkable that there is a respectable figure in public life in this country who still argues for the merit of the Vietnam War. And I think it's good that there is somebody around who does that. I could not disagree with him more profoundly, but it's good that there is someone out there doing it. It's good that there is someone around, I suppose, defending George Pell. But you see, this is where you do need to get to the facts. And it's great colour in the biography for Jared to describe me as a born-again atheist with sectarian views and anti-Catholic prejudices and all of that kind of thing. And all of that, I mean, I don't believe it's true, but that's fine. But motive doesn't matter when you're bringing the truth to light. Motive doesn't matter. I believe my motives, as far as Pell are concerned, he is a person who has a real case to answer. Jared doesn't acknowledge this, but there are facts there that present Pell in a very poor light, and he will have an opportunity from the 29th of February to address some of them. It doesn't help anybody just to attack me as a bigot. And indeed, that splendid man, Francis Sullivan, who I'm sure you know, Jared, who runs the Truth, Justice and Healing Commission for the Church, which is the body for the Catholic Church, which is representing the Church before the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Abuse. Francis delivered a very interesting speech last year in which he begged people not to defend the Church by attacking its critics as bigots. It's a very eloquent speech. It's up on the internet, and I really recommend it to people. He says, look, the Church did terrible things, and the Church has terrible things to answer for. Don't make the mistake of saying there's an unfair focus on the Catholic Church, that these people who criticise the bishops are bigots. There are facts and sad facts that have to be dealt with. Now, I have never heard Jared actually come to grips with the facts that George Pell has to answer. He makes claims for him, but I've never heard him actually come to grips with them.
What he did come to grips with, I thought, was that, and I think I'm correctly, he said that no one else has had their appearance flagged in advance by the Royal Commission as they did about Pell. And that this was...
That's just not true.
Is that not true?
As far as I know, the witness list is known ahead of time.
Yes, but this was...
But not with the dates.
No, it was... And
yes.
I must say, I thought that was a very interesting remark, and that was a fact, which I actually found...
Say it's true. What's the point?
Well, The notion is that he is the person who everyone agrees is the person who will, in effect, be cop the flak. He's the big bad bogey
in the
entire thing. And by flagging his appearance, I mean, you know, we've had
sorry, this, I don't get it. I mean,
can I make a comment?
I just don't get it.
Just on that, I mean, it is true that Bill Shelton was at the Gallipoli Club here when he last spoke about a year and a bit ago, and I did make that point. I mean, I'm a bit different from David. See, David got offended when I said I thought Pell was wise not to talk to him. And he got offended when I said I thought...
Not offended, it's just not... It's just not what you do if you're interested in public debate.
But I do what I do, you know. And I think...
Well, are you interested in public debate?
Well, of course I am. But that's why I'm here, you see. And that's why we've asked both of you here before, you see. And it is true that I said I thought Tony Abbott was unwise to speak to him, although it was off the record. I mean, I don't really care whether people speak to me. I mean, I wrote to all of Santa Maria's family to talk to me about my book, and everyone I wrote to refused. All of Santa Maria's workers all refused. I didn't get offended. I didn't care. They didn't want to speak to me. They didn't want to speak to me. I mean, what does it matter? I think they probably should have, but I didn't care. I don't get offended if people don't speak to me. Lots of people don't speak to me. You'd be surprised about how many people don't speak to me. I don't really care.
Well, but that's not what I'm not offended. I'm
well,
not offended.
Offended.
I'm just, no, I'm shocked. I was shocked.
No.
I was shocked to hear somebody say that a politician should not talk to a journalist. Because that is a political operator's judgment.
I didn't.
It is not a public discussion judgment. That is about political advantage.
That in other words, you're saying you're standing in different corners
and
of the room.
And it's a reminder to me that Jared and I are terribly different people.
But when I said to you, and this is when you blew up in front of... I mean, some people are still suffering shock who are in that taxi queue because they're looking around, the taxi's coming in now. We're at 4 and 5 and going to one another.
Yes.
The guy's saying, you go down to 3, you go down to 2. And they're all looking around. Someone from overseas, and I thought, this is a pretty odd place. Right.
But the wonderful thing about Jared is he always wants to share the taxi with you after you've had the row.
But you did say, I mean, what happened was, as we walked down, I was doing what Malcolm Fraser used to call, you know, doing the hypocrisies, and I was trying to talk about the weather, and I spoke a bit about Pell, and you just turned to me and you said, well, you know, Pell refused to speak to me, and I just said, thinking this was completely obnoxious, sorry, the reverse. Innocuous. He thought it was obnoxious, yeah. I said, I think that was a pretty wise decision on his behalf, and David told me he'd never been so offended in all his life. Now, if that's the most he's been ever offended, he doesn't get my correspondence. But I mean, just make one point about, I don't want to go on about this, because I have written about Pell. I mean, the reason why, I mean, I've never been asked on, there's never been a debate on the ABC involving Cardinal Pell that I've ever been asked on. David's been on.
You're
on the drum, for example.
Oh, yes, you're right.
Not with Pell on, though.
Well, you see, the problem is, I'm a little bit of a factoid. I got this, all this stuff. My head is full of trivia, of a factual kind. But I've never been invited to any kind of discussion. So the only discussions I have are in my column in The Australian or in my Media Watchdog blog. In my column in The Australian recently, I have said that Archbishop Frank Little and of Melbourne and Bishop Mulcans of Ballarat were clearly aware of paedophilia in the church and clearly covered it up. Both were progressive Catholics. They weren't conservative Catholics. I've made that point. I think a lot of the evidence against Pell has already been shot down at the inquiries, and he's got his own legal representation to be heard at the end of February, and he's entitled to be heard. But so far there's been no causal linking, and we'll see what comes up. He's got his own legal representation. If I'd been in the Royal Commission, I would have heard it in December. They're going to hear it at the end of February. It doesn't matter whether he's in Rome or whether he's in Sydney or Melbourne, it can be heard. All I'm saying is he's entitled to that. But I just make the point is that the reason why I'm a gladiator is because I say unfashionable things.
But a lot of people
I could
do.
Say things with the same intensity, running all the fashionable opinions across all the left-wing agenda in this country, and people would think I was just a nice sort of guy.
Jared, you're not across the facts with Pell, and I
am across the facts. I've read all the transcripts.
I've
written about it.
Are you not troubled by the Searson case?
Pell was an auxiliary. Look, I don't think we
You're
should go into all this
Searson
here.
Case.
No, I'm not. Searson was a priest who packed a gun.
Yeah. Searson liked having confession with little girls that he pressed against his erection. Searson was tried to be got rid of by the headmaster of the parish school. In Victoria, of course, the parish priest is the head of the parish school. Instead, the church got rid of the fine headmaster. Pell took a delegation of parents and teachers, begging him to get rid of this wild priest who also beat children. An investigation of some kind was held, and the priest remained. The Searson case is a very difficult case
David,
for
if
Pell.
I can just make a point, I don't think we should spend the night on this, but if I can make just
but
a
But don't
of,
make the claim
on.
That he has no case to answer because you don't know what you're talking about.
I didn't say he has no case to answer. I said his case will be examined in February. That's what I said.
No, it'll be examined before then.
Hang on. He's going before the Royal Commission in February. Right?
Yeah.
It'll be examined in February.
Yep.
The Victoria Police refused to prosecute Searson. And the point I make about Pell was the auxiliary bishop at Melbourne, put in by the Pope to succeed Little, and Little, the archbishop who ran the place, didn't like him, didn't agree with him, rarely spoke to him. So Pell was sent in there to undermine Little by the Vatican. They didn't get on.
And has
come up in the Royal Commission. It was said before the Royal Commission that one of the other priests said that if whoever went to Little was never going to do anything. He ran the place. The minute Pell came in, he acted. So I don't think we should go on about that. I've written about it. But the reason why I haven't engaged in discussion on it is because no one's ever asked me. I don't get asked to do these things. I mean, they talk to David Maher, they talk to all these other people. They don't talk to me. Well, I don't really care.
I understand.
I'm not lying awake at night trying to get an invite. But if when I write the stuff, I put the facts in.
Look,
The Pell thing is an immense quagmire that we should stay out of.
I do think we should. Yeah. But I am going to throw it open because we really are.
But I want to say one thing before you do, if I may. Just briefly, because I think it's an important point and I'll make it very briefly. And that's this. You heard Gerard then say that Mulcairns, who was truly shocking bishop of Ballarat, and Little, they were progressives. Now, it matters. It's important for Gerard that these very bad bishops were progressives. And Gerard has sort of suggested that because I'm a progressive, I'm somehow implicated or somehow I've got something to answer for.
And this is
the mildest thing. And I want to say something now more important. I think in the business of public discussion in this country, the categorisation of people as left to indicate that they are sinister or untrustworthy is completely exhausted. It is done. There is a boutique audience for it, but it is essentially done. 10 years ago, when I was writing a piece for Overland about what it means to be left in Australia, I asked Gerard, amongst a number of other people, to tell me what they thought left meant. And Gerard wrote me a long and very carefully considered and nuanced definition of what it meant to be left. And I valued that because what he gets to there is the extraordinary number of categories of left there are, of the different kinds of left there are. And he went through them meticulously. But then again, but he is still using, in this day and age, the category of left in his argument as if it were one thing. And he mentioned earlier progressive agenda. I think you were talking about the progressive agenda. These mysterious agendas, which are supposed to make people like me dangerous or untrustworthy.
David,
just a second. I've got one or two sentences to go.
They're long sentences.
I think this is a busted form of public discussion in this country. Left is not a meaningless expression. Right is not a meaningless expression. Conservative is not a meaningless expression. They have their uses. But to categorise people in a way which, I mean, there's never a column of Gerard's which doesn't attack somebody as being left. And his biography is fabulous. On every couple of pages, somebody's left, leftist, left, leftist. You know where you stand as you read the biography. But I just wanted to make the point, a bigger point than us just brawling with one another, is that I think public discussion in this country has shed that form of combat as useless.
Okay, last word to you before we throw it open to...
Well, I'll try and make it a It'll be a brief word like David. David's, and I won't go on for more than 25 minutes, but... I did speak out about hyperbole, and I think we just had an example of it. And I'm not really blaming David for all the world's problems, but all I did was, and when I first wrote this in the Sydney Morning Herald, I was then writing for, and David rang me up and very annoyed said he'd never said it, but he had said it, so I produced the tape. Well, when you spoke at the
UTS, this is a big UTS quote,
well,
ladies and gentlemen.
Can I just finish?
Pay attention.
Okay, thanks. Can I say now? Great, thanks.
No. Don't miss a
the
word.
The natural culture of journalism is a kind of vaguely soft-left inquiry, and you told journalists that if they weren't soft-lefty kind of culture types, they should get out and get another job. Now, that's a decade ago. So, you know, you're using this, and then anyone who says the same thing and politely answers your queries, you say they're obsessed. But, I mean, you said if you weren't on the left, you should get out of journalism.
I made a complete hash of it that night. It is not my view. It is not my view, and has never been my view, that only lefties can be journalists. I admire right-wing journalists enormously. I was talking in a completely cack-handed way about people who define all kinds of scepticism as left-wing. I made a mess of it. When Gerard produced the quote, I wrote a letter to The Australian setting out, or to The Herald, wherever it was, setting out my actual views. Gerard, you are absolutely free to quote till doomsday what I said at UTS that night. I think, in all honesty, you should say that I admitted to making a mistake and withdrawing it, but you never do.
David, I just want to make one point. The difference here is that...
Wimbledon umpire here.
If I say something, I believe it. I don't go around the next day and say, oh, gee, I stuffed up, I shouldn't have said that. I mean, I wouldn't say it if I didn't believe it.
Oh, but you're allowed to make a mistake. You're allowed to pull back, surely.
So my correction is regarded as a lie.
No,
so,
it's not a lie.
Okay, anyway, look, anyway. I'm joining in. Yes, yes, sir, and please. Now, we're not in front of any... Anne's in charge.
Okay, I'll just call to Scott, so we don't get any...
How are we going to hear the question on the tape?
You will, and you can repeat it if you don't.
Okay.
Geraldine can repeat
it. Yeah, I'll repeat it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good.
First of all, my name's Scott Eastwood. I'm the director of the Delivery Club. And thank you, Geraldine, for having wonderful night. And welcome, everyone. I think what I've seen tonight, for a person my age, who early 50s, sadly, early 50s, that has been politically active over time, that has been on the right and dabbled with the left, I see the problem with Geraldine, I'm talking to you, not the others, I see the problem with the Australian debate. It is polarised. And we have two giants, intellectual giants, that are capable of assessing a whole range of issues in their own right. One is marginally deceitful.
The
other is entirely inconsistent.
Keep both for television.
And it worries that I find that an issue because the product of the Australian debate is a result of those interpretations. And if we could only get less deceitful in order to push a barrow, and I understand why, and if we get more consistency in terms of the other philosophy, then we might be at a point where we can have a sensible conversation and achieve the results that I actually think, at the end, if you boil it down in some sort of silly, you know, futuristic sense, we might end up with something that we all agree with.
Thank you, Scott. Now, in other words, can we improve by actually having more... I suppose, would it be as much fun? That's the question. But would less inconsistency, less deceitfulness.
Do you want to answer?
Does anybody...
I don't think David's deceitful, and I'm not sure what was said about me. I was a bit overwhelmed by the...
Incoherent,
by the
was
phone.
It? Scott, what was the word? Inconsistent.
Inconsistent. Well, what am I to say? No, I don't think I think David and I just disagree on some things. It's be pretty dull if we didn't. I don't think we're very deceitful, but I don't know.
Look, I think the key word that you used there, Scott, was about polarising. And I think another aspect of public debate in this country, which we are just sick of, is for every issue to be divided, your side versus my side, as though there were only two opinions or two teams. Whenever I hear the metaphor of war applied to public debate, I just want to puke. It is crude, it is oversimplified, it is deliberately designed to be brutal, it is supposed to justify all kinds of otherwise really unjustifiable tactics. Public debate in this country at its best is nuanced. It is not about sides. It is not about left versus right, progressives versus conservatives, Catholics versus atheists. It is about the nuanced facts of the situations at hand. And it's the polarising, the cheapening polarising, which I think people are just sick of.
Okay,
Smitty,
yes.
Due to a rather meagre social life, for many years I've watched Q&A and insiders religiously. And one of the things which pops out time and time again is that those people who represent the Labour Party and the Greens tend to always talk over the people who represent the coalition people, the people by and large from the coalition, from the Institute of Public Affairs, from Judith Sloan, and all the other conservative commentators. They tend to be rather polite, whereas on those programs, those people who represent, you should pardon the phrase, the left point of view, say Greens and Labour, will always talk over it and interrupt. And David, I must say that I was quite pleased to see you tonight. You're great, but on Insiders, Jared hardly gets a word in edgewise before you all over the top of him.
That's why people love it.
It would be lovely if the moderators on those programs were really strong and would just tell somebody to let the other person get a word in edgewise, which is very much. They did, and this last Monday's one, okay, but by and large, it's pretty awful.
Can you repeat that?
Well, the suggestion the right of centre people on Insiders and Q&A are talked over by the left of centre people. That's the suggestion.
Yeah, that was the left of centre and the Greens thing.
That the right is polite. Shall we say the conservative side is polite and the leftists and Greens tend to be impolite.
Well, that's because they all went to the same courtesy school that I went to. Where I learned courtesy at a young age.
Just watch it next time. Just make a note next time and you'll see it.
It's never a good idea to speak over somebody else, and I do it a lot.
Why?
An impatient.
Hang on, there's a very interesting answer coming here. Go on.
An impatient wish on my part that nothing should stand between the public and the truth.
Thank you. Good
the lady down there. Thank you.
That's a good excuse.
With the Republican and Democratic primaries going on in America at the moment, I'm just wondering your thoughts on the benefits or otherwise that the current debate series brings to the American democratic system.
So what are the current merits of the American system of electoral leading up to the election and, the gains, yes, the wins, the losses, and the how would you score it, as it were? Derek?
Well, what surprises me is that on cable TV, the debates seem to rate reasonably well, so obviously people watch them. I find them rather tedious because people are essentially saying the same thing over and over again, but if people watch them and they're entertained by them, I don't have a problem with them. I think I watch some of them. But they seem to work. I mean, it's a different political culture. I don't think our debates here are a bit different. We don't have as many of them. I don't know they lead to much breakthrough, but they're kind of an endurance. If you can get through them all, you can probably deserve to be president, I think.
We should have more debates in this country at election time. The fact that we have so few is very sad. In the United States, there is a pressure to have these debates. I was recently trapped in a hotel room in Honolulu and with nothing to do but watch the Iowa debates. And I think What they really do is to show how completely, completely in trouble the United States is. And for outs, I don't know what it is like to be an American and watch those debates, but to be a friend of America, such as myself, somebody who admires, I've got some profound criticisms of that country, but somebody who admires the country very much, to watch those gladiators posturing in the way they are is deeply, deeply depressing.
Yes, I must say I would have thought that one of the things about, the polarisation of the US, I really feel makes ours look like a picnic. You know, we still do, I think, have a centre that can be appealed to, and I can't, it's very hard to find that in the US, so, you know, it troubles me immensely. Yes, go ahead.
One thing, I mean, there seems to be a lamenting of the polarising adversarial nature of the public debate, but our parliamentary system is polarising adversarial, our judicial system is polarising adversarial. Is it not the case that we're trapped in this sort of a public debate because we're essentially in that sort of a country? That's our system. That's how it's being structured. That's how it works.
Are we trapped in a sort of Westminster system where, but not just in politics, in the law, in we're very bifurcated. That's really what you're saying. What do you think, Jerry?
Well, I think you can exaggerate. I don't think the debate in Australia is that polarised because I don't think the society is very polarised. I mean, what we're debating about here, if someone come from North America or Western Europe, probably wouldn't think there's much division in this society, and I don't think there is. I mean, that's why in my columns I tend to stay away from politicians and look at other people in the public debate, because if apart from the Greens, there's not a great deal of difference between the mainstream Labour Party and the mainstream coalition party. So I think we can exaggerate it. I don't think the society is all that polarised because there are not many great issues. There are some issues, and then it's the way in which the matters are handled. But it is true when every word a politician speaks is going to be reported, politicians are going to be much more cautious about what they say, and that's what's led to the situation where most politicians say virtually nothing, because even the slightest comment they made will be taken and beaten up. And so there are a few politicians around who will speak loosely, and others won't. I mean, I think Tony Abbott was much more effective before he became opposition leader because he was much freer. He froze up when he became opposition leader. He froze up even more as Prime Minister. Most of our political leaders do that because they're warned not to make a mistake. I think it's better if people do make mistakes, but there are penalties for making mistakes. But I don't think it's all that polarised here. I think the debate in Australia was much more polarised after the Second World War, when there was a genuine issue of free enterprise against socialism, when the Labour Party wanted to socialise the private trading banks, and that was much more polarised. I think we were much more polarised in the 50s, where about 40% of the parliamentary Labour Party wanted to end the American alliance, when quite a few of them, as we now know from the ASIO records and from what people like Mark Arons have declared, many of them were in the pay of communist parties in Beijing and Moscow, and there was a great battle between the communists and the anti-communists, which was in the Labour movement, but also between the Labour Party and the Conservative Party. So I think there were much more divisions in society then than there is now. Now there are not many great debates around. If you take Malcolm Turnbull and you take Bill Shorten, there's not a great deal of debate between them. There's stuff at the margin, but I don't think it's very polarised. But
I think the fact that the Westminster system is so polarised, one you know, the government against the opposition, it's one of the greatest political inventions of the millennium. That parties be organised in such a disciplined way in order to govern. It's frankly, ladies and gentlemen, what the United States requires. I mean, how can you run a government when the leader of the country doesn't control the budget? Anyway, we'll put that to one side. That's not to be solved. The fact that courts are in this very formal way polarised, between them, the courts and the parliament compel the rest of us to be as little polarised as possible. They compel the rest of society to be as nuanced and free-flowing in our arguments as we possibly can be. I agree with Jared. I don't actually think the community is so polarised at the moment. And that's why earlier I was complaining about attempts to run polarising arguments of left-right, you know, progressive-conservative. I don't think they're very useful because we need to get to the facts. There are some great issues in this country at the moment. I think the refugee issue is a great issue in this country and an issue which will determine the reputation of this country in the outside world for a very long time. And I'm hoping that we are beginning to have a fresh and nuanced argument about that. But that's a very polarising argument.
What about education? Surely education is a giant debate that we're not having sufficiently. With very, very strongly held views, which will absolutely determine the future of our country. And that's not regarded as polarised. I actually think it's quite polarised, the education debate.
The polls being?
Well, I think there's the private versus the public. There's that sense of whether we really do need to invest in whether we're adequately spreading the cup of money properly. I think that's a very, very big debate.
Geraldine, I'm not going to sit here and hear my old school implicitly criticised just because Shaw is about to spend $30 million building a new grandstand at its sports ground is no reason whatever that federal funding should cease for that school. I know what you're getting at.
Yes, Ed.
Can you believe it?
We've heard a lot tonight about the Royal Commission into
institutional responses to child sexual abuse.
I turned off that issue a long time ago. It's been dragging on for so long that I just wonder how much longer it's going to drag on for.
A year.
My question is, has the money that has been spent on it been worthwhile?
So has the money being spent on the Royal Commission into Child Sexual Abuse been worthwhile, essentially? Gerard?
I supported the Royal Commission. I mean, how much money you spend, how many staff you have in these instances is a matter for governments and bureaucracies to work out. I mean, I've no idea whether they're spending too much or too little or it's about right. What George Pell said originally was he didn't mind the Catholic Church being there, provided it was a situation where the Catholic Church wasn't the only cab on the rank. And, I mean, it has been proven that there are many cabs on the rank, sadly. I mean, this problem has gone deeply through religious bodies, religious churches, secular institutions, government departments, and more besides. And we haven't even looked at the personal relationships yet, and they won't be covered. And we haven't looked at the media yet, and it may or may not be covered. The media was found deeply involved in Britain. I mean, the scandals in the BBC were absolutely shocking.
Oh, yes.
At this stage, the Royal Commission hasn't looked at the media, but the media is an institution in which many young people work or have worked. So we'll see what happens there. But certainly the scandals in the BBC were absolutely atrocious, and they're still coming out. So, I'm as to where they spend too much or not, I don't know. But I do know, well... I don't want to go on about it, but if there's another point to be made, I'll make it later.
Well, this is not facts. This is your... I think the questioner is about your opinion, which is... I mean, that's what he's...
Well, it depends what the agenda is, and I've written about this. The agenda should be about how child sex abuse took place in religious and other institutions. But as I read the commission, and I read the submissions, I read the reports, one of the agendas of the commission seems to be about, you know, who should prevail within the Catholic Church, whether there should be celibacy or whether there should not be celibacy. I mean, it seems to me this has nothing to do with the Royal Commission. But these questions are being put. I mean, a question was put that wasn't ruled out to a priest about the Latin Mass. I mean, for God's sake, what's the Latin Mass got to do with the Royal Commission? So I think to some extent it's going off the edges. As I read a lot of the transcripts, I think a lot of the testimony is not worth giving. It doesn't relate to the topic. Others of it does. But if you read some of the transcripts and you read at what counsel assisting, and not only counsel assisting, counsel for the various others involved, victims and others, I mean, some of this stuff is very esoteric that has nothing to do with the topic. I mean, why would the Royal Commission allow a witness to be asked a question about the Latin Mass, which went out of the Catholic Church about 50 years ago. I mean, I don't understand that. But by and large, I think it's done good work, and it's been very revealing, and it's been revealing about many institutions, and we'll see how many other institutions get involved. But I don't want to spend the whole night talking about that. David.
On the night that she retired, sacked as Prime Minister, Julia Gillard listed some of her achievements. And she said of the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Abuse, which was fought and fought and fought by the Catholic Church for a decade, fought to the limit by the Catholic Church. Pell denounced it from the pulpit, denounced the very idea from the pulpit of St. Mary's Cathedral 2 days before it was announced. They fought it hard, the Anglicans fought it hard, people fought it hard, and she did it. And she said it'll change Australia. And I think it will. It will change Australia. And it will change our view of religions. It will change our view of closed institutions which have hitherto been allowed to operate without the proper oversight of law. It will change us, and we'll be a better country for it. If I were ever to write a book about this, and I'm not going to, I'd give it a simple title. Just Call the Cops. This is all about what those institutions did instead of just calling the cops. And this is going to be a triumph for civil justice in this country at great pain, worth every penny.
You have to repeat my question.
Yeah.
It's a really banal question after the depth of those comments about education and cumulative disadvantage. But my question is really about your views on social media and the fact that in this Twitter sphere, there is no debate. We are restricted to just so many letters per tweet. And I fear that the next generation or three down will be focused in the social media area on very limited discourse because of the way social media is played in our community. And it's the main communication tool. So I'm interested in your views on the pluses and the minuses of social media, of Facebook, tweets, blogs, and so on.
The pluses and the minuses of social media, whether, in fact, the very thing we've been talking about, whether it's going to reduce, whether it's going to be reductionist, basically, about the art of argument.
Well, obviously, as Catherine would know, we can't do anything about it, and I think it's more. I think it is more abusive than other parts of the media, but not. It's not in that alone. I mean, there is a lot of abuse around, a lot of sneering, and so I think all we can do is adapt to it. I don't open up my blog to comment because I can't spend all the hours getting rid of the defamation that people are going to put on it. So I don't engage in that kind of stuff. I don't think David's on Twitter. I'm not on Twitter because I don't have time. But I do monitor it. I do like to find out what other people's are saying, particularly Mike Carlton after lunch.
Yes!
Mike Carlton during gin and tonic time and this sort of stuff. What's going on at Palm Beach, looking into crystal bowls. And I have my agents who monitor to me and send me stuff quite regularly, actually. It's very nice. Keep those tweets coming, folks. I suppose this was a problem that emerged with every new form of communication. But I think what it's essentially done is to just increase the level of abuse. But the level of abuse is not simply of people who are new to the debate. I mean, a lot of people who would normally say something in 5,000 words now tell people to piss off in 2 words.
There's a plus to that.
But I'm too courteous to do it. I mean,
simpler.
But neither of us tweet. Are you on Facebook?
No, I'm not.
No, neither am I. No, there is somebody called David Maher on Facebook. I have cousins called David Maher, and there was a very nice man who was the police chaplain in South Australia called Dave Martin. I feel very, very sorry for anybody else. There must be other Gerard Hendersons around.
Well, there was a fake Gerard Henderson up because he was involved in eating many biscuits, and this fooled Crikey, who sort of ran and said, you know, what's Henderson been doing today? He's commenting on biscuits, but it wasn't me. They probably were my biscuits, but it wasn't me. So I do have, but I don't have a real presence there. No, I'm not trying to do it, actually.
I do understand what my current employers, Fairfax and now The Guardian. They are desperate for me to tweet. Mm. It gives you an interactive presence on the site, which really delights readers. But frankly, I don't have time, and I don't hugely have the appetite for it. And I know that I would be the one who tweeted the absolutely unforgivable tweet. I would end my career. But, I mean, most of the time I think I'm going to end my career by needlessly and impatiently crossing a street without looking where the traffic is coming. That's the most likely way that I will die. But the most likely way, if I were a tweeter, to end my career would be the great last tweet.
But it would be, David, the ultimate truth, as you pointed out.
No, not necessarily. But it's an appalling thing. I mean, I was having, I have to say, a drink with.
Gosh, who?
He just mentioned his name.
Ah.
Yes.
Gin and Tonic Carlton.
With my.
Oh.
At the Writers Festival. At the Writers Festival one year. And I said to him, Mike, I've worked out Gerard Henson. He's just a crank. And I, look, that's the kind of thing that old colleagues say to one another. And it's,
he tweeted it.
And he immediately tweeted it to my grotesque embarrassment. So I then had to go into print in the Sydney papers to convince Gerard that he actually was a crank. I mean, the whole thing had the most ugly repercussions.
But I was very grateful because I took it out as an endorsement and published it on Media Watchdog. So it's still there if you trace it down on the blog.
I think they're Gerard the wrong generation. Because, you know...
I don't get much praise these days.
But I do think the up and down nature... The etiquette of a new outlet, this is what happened with phones too, and they developed an etiquette, and I think there will be an etiquette creep in. But if you do watch the way young ones assume there'll be gigantic sort of ebb and flow, almost like ocean waves coming in and out on social media, it's very different, I think, to the etiquette and understanding of an older generation about argument. So I think it's a work in progress, and one of the things I think is sort of incredibly provocative is, can the older generation contribute at all or not? I leave that as an open question.
But isn't the spectacular thing about Geraldine is that she keeps up? She's past this stuff. She keeps up.
Yes, I have a 22-year-old who watches Reddit. I don't know how many of you do actually take part in Reddit, which is a great social media site. And he alerts me to what I ought to know. Sorry, Anne.
It's really encouraging that you're both on a unity ticket.
About facts.
The importance of facts.
Yes.
One of the things that I suppose is most of us here, we are interested in current affairs, and one of the things that I notice, having gone to, for instance, Question Time in the British Parliament, seeing what is happening in Australia about the lack of business to get hold of facts, the inability of journalists to get information, to go to refugee camps, the attitudes about freedom for information. Why wouldn't it be that two public figures like you would be really in the vanguard of attacking the restrictions on access to the facts that seems to have very much crept in on both sides of politics over the last 15, 20 years?
Why wouldn't these two gentlemen be in the vanguard of objecting to the restrictions on access to facts that our questioners suggested has invaded us in the last 10 to 15 years? On both sides of politics, I think.
Well, I've written a great deal about that. Continue to write about it, and I speak about it as well when I'm on Insiders and other public appearances. I mean, one of the most disgraceful things that the Labour Party has taken part in the last year was to back the government's Border Force Act, which threatens medical personnel with 2 years in prison for telling the truth about what's happening on Manus and Nauru. And, you know, I said to Shorten, how can you do that? How can you be a party to closing down public discussion and access to those facts? Mumble, mumble, bleh, mumble, mumble, bleh.
Yeah, but the difference here is that I've worked with a senior level in opposition. I've worked for 3 years. I've worked at a senior level in government for 4 years. I know how hard government is. And if you take the current issue of refugees, in which underneath. I mean, Anne's done more work in this area than I have, but I'm not against David's motives here. But I know there are a lot of activity can be completely counterproductive. And the more this is made a public issue, the less likely the remaining 2,000 people will be released. And the more people offer sanctuary in churches and spout their conscience in public, the less likely it is that people will respond. So, to some extent, I often think that things are better done quietly. And if you'd note what happened, and I spoke to John Howard towards the end of his government, and I spoke to John Howard after the 2004 election. I went around and saw him in his office after he'd won. And in the remaining years, all those people were let out, but no one said anything. They're all living in the community. Most of them are now Australian citizens. But it wasn't done by beating down the door, because beating down the door leads to a reaction, because once you go back to where you were, the problem starts again. So I'm quite sympathetic to Bill Shorten. I'm sympathetic to Malcolm Turnbull. I'm sympathetic to Tony Abbott. Gillard and Rudd and all the others, Howard, had to deal with it. It's a very difficult problem. So it's a question of whether investigations, public pronouncements in the long run help. Sometimes they do. Sometimes they're counterproductive. And I think you've got to draw the balance. And if you're conscious about how government works and how difficult government broadly defined is, which is government, the public service, the whole lot that goes together, the opposition, it's an incredibly difficult job. And I'm rather sympathetic to the people who've got to deal with these huge problems.
That's Robert Mann's point, of course.
That couldn't better define the difference between Gerard and me. Could not better define it. I believe in public discussion, I believe in noise, I believe in revelation, I believe in the truth coming out. And if this system is beginning to come unstuck, it is because truths have been told, it's because medical practitioners have come forward and told what damage is being done to children and to adults in these camps. It's because we are getting some reporting.
No, but that's not really the case. See, what the case was that when the Abbott government came to office, there were thousands of people in detention. There were 2,000 children in detention. There are 200 left now. So this problem... What's that?
It's down to 80.
They're down to 80 left. So this problem has to be... Howard resolved after... I mean, I had public disagreements with John Howard on this, but in the end it was all worked out. Howard resolved the problem. When Howard left office, there were none left in detention, adults or children. When Abbott came in, he inherited this problem, and now there are very few left. There are about 2,000 left in detention. Most of them are in the community. So what's happened is that these matters have been resolved, and the people who've actually resolved the issue are people who deal with pragmatic politics. It's slow boring through hard boards. It's not the expressive stuff. I have a conscience. I want to express my conscience. I want to rage against the system. I mean, that's all very well, but it doesn't achieve anything. What achieves things is very slow work. And I think if everyone went quiet on this...
Oh, for heaven's sake.
That's Robert Mann's point of view, too.
Robert Mann came to this very late.
If the clerics... I was telling this to Robert Mann years ago. If the clerics went back to the churches and everyone quietened down, this could be resolved. But if you're going to have a situation where 2,000 people are publicly taken off Manus Island and off at the other parts of New Guinea, what will happen is the whole thing will start again. So... I'm interested in practical, empirical politics. I'm sympathetic to the coalition. I'm sympathetic to Labour. I'm not interested in expressive politics, although I understand lots of people who have very good motives, but I'm interested in consequences. I'm not interested in motives. But we differ.
We differ completely. That is an operative's point of view. Mine is a journalist's point of view. I don't believe this problem is going to be solved.
But I say one thing.
This problem is not going to be solved until we know what is going on.
But I never
it is an immense cause of satisfaction to have discovered via the High Court that Australia has got nothing to do with it. I've got two theories now. One, perhaps Spain. Two, maybe Romania. And if I've got any time in the next few months, it's just shameful. Let me say one more thing. This is the most perfect definition of the difference between us. The most perfect.
Okay. Right. Now I did want to ask them. where they thought this was heading. And I always like to leave these sorts of conversations attempting to be vaguely constructive about the future. Oh, silly me. But let's give it a go. Where would you like public discourse to head, Jared, ideally?
I'm not too fussed. I would like a bit more pluralism, more views expressed on places like the ABC and in Fairfax Media than is currently the case.
I think News Limited as well. More pluralism in News Limited.
Well, I mean, News Limited runs Philip Adams. I mean,
and you
and me. I mean, there's quite a degree of pluralism. I mean, I tell you what, there's more pluralism on Fox News than there is on the ABC in terms of Fox actually pays quite a number of left of centre commentators to comment. The ABC has not one conservative in any prominent program. So this, I'm all for diversity. I think we could do with more in Australia. I'm not so pessimistic about the debate. I think the standard of debate in this country is
not
quite
bad.
Is quite good.
Yeah. Okay. Standard debate in this country is not bad. You will not be surprised that I think the ABC is one of the most important institutions in this country, and a 20-year campaign, often led by Jared, to say that it is. I mean, Alan Ashbolt is still alive in Jared's mind, which is fabulous, because how long ago did he die?
The kindergarten is still at the school.
Oh, I know. They all lefties. And there isn't a single conservative, and, you know, Amanda Vanstone isn't conservative enough.
Which you don't say.
You know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But after all of these campaigns, the culture wars against the ABC, the terrible bias of the ABC, survey after survey of the Australian people say that the ABC is amongst the most trusted institutions in this country. Year after year, it is up there with the High Court. The High Court and the ABC.
The High Court. You just condemned the High Court.
Well, I'll...
That's pretty bad. The ABC is bad as the High Court.
I've got a lot of criticisms of the ABC as well, but the notion that it is a closed shop is not shared by the Australian people. It's one of the great institutions we have in this country, and I'm very glad that we've also got Foxtel. I'm very glad we've also got Sky. I'm very glad that we've got News Limited. The death of the Australian newspaper would be a tragedy for this country, and it may well happen. The death of Fairfax would be a tragedy for this country. Thank goodness we've got The Guardian. But I reckon public debate is in pretty good shape. But there is a real problem that politicians can't get outside their party lines. And when they're out in public, and particularly as a problem on Q&A, you get these politicians who are locked into party positions. And Jared made a good point before that we should be more forgiving of politicians who make mistakes as they venture in public debate about where we should be going in this country. I think there's a real problem with the press diving on the tiniest discrepancy between what somebody said and what the Prime Minister said. That's a great problem. But I reckon public debate isn't bad. And here are two people who can barely stand to be in the same room together, chatting away for an hour and a half.
When are you both next on Insiders?
Sunday week.
I can barely wait.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you both. Jared Henderson.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.